I'm Sequoia Ezekwe for Ear to the Streets of Portland on the best community radio station on the planet, KBOO Community Radio, KBOO Portland.
Join KBOO around the campfire. Become a member during Camp KBOO's Summer Drive, taking place now through June 29th. Your contribution goes toward grassroots community radio. Donate now by going to kboo.fm/give. Thank you.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We have a room full of poets here, more than we can imagine, powerful voices in the community, and they are called The Right Blend, W-R-I-T-E, Blend. And Diane Wilbon Parks is the progenitor of this, or the leader, and she's going to tell you what it is. What is the Right Blend Collective?
The Right Blend is a unique poetry circle with very distinctive talents and gifts from each of these poets. So we have six poets, and each of them are uniquely different. We wanted to do something more or less with cultural diversity as well as poetic and artistic diversity. So diversity is on all levels here.
And we have some signature music, I understand, that you have performed every time that you are presented. That's Cliff Bernier. And if you hear that, you will always know it's the Right Blend. So he'll be showing his talent more with his own poetry. So as we speak, tell everyone your names. And I'm very interested in why anyone wants to get together in a group when poetry is such an individual enterprise. So I'd like each of you to tell me, why bother? Why do this? Why put your time out to be part of a whole instead of being totally individual? So just give your name and tell me about that.
Sure. My name is Kyan Thomas. One of the reasons why I'm excited about being a part of The Right Blend is an opportunity to expose myself, challenge myself, my own poetic gifts to other levels of diversity to expand that gift.
Hello, I'm Billie O'Kara, and my being in the group is just an invitation for me to get out into the community. I had stayed shut up with my poetry for so long. It's been a couple of years since I've been out, and so Diane's invitation was just a gift.
My name is Liz Reitzig, and part of the beauty of this group to me is how empowering it is to be among a group of poets. And at the same time, we each have a safe space to be truly expressive what it means to us in our poetry and to be accepted and belong in this group.
I love it.
I'm Hiram LaRue. I like the group because I like moonlight. And I like the reflection, gleam, and glow of this collective group.
So now you know the quality of the voices.
I'm Cliff Bernier, and I'm part of this group because it connects me with the diversity of perspectives and poetic styles in the community.
Well, we are going to hear these poetic perspectives and styles now, and we're going to hear a poem from each one of these collectives, and you will see how individual, how unique, and how very special each voice is. And the reason coming together is like putting different parts of a spectrum into little quadrants into a pie to make a whole. So I would love to hear your work. If you want to set it up first, that'll be great. So just tell us the name of the poem. Maybe if it has a backstory, you can give us that. And we'll start with Cayenne. Give us your name first so they can remember you.
Sure, Cayenne Thomas. I am going to read a poem that is called There Is Blood on the Cotton. It was actually a writing prompt received from the Right Blend to let the word color or the concept of color inspire you. There is blood on the cotton. Snowy white and neatly folded rows of tees stand at attention in the dresser, each one whispering, pick me, as eyes scan the open drawer. Textile perfection, almost, until the nick on his chin drips. There is blood on the cotton. And like that, the fabric of our lives is the fiber of his anguish. Rows of cloud-like purity stained with the blood of human chattel, King Cotton ruled with a leather whip. The economic backbone broke down many black bones, making bank bones, but only for the bones covered in white skin. Men, women, and children bow in reverence to a hot sun and a cold king. Racing against daylight, ignoring the screams of their worn bodies, backs bent, hands picked, fingers pricked, blood drips, and there is blood on the cotton. Camera flash forward. Snowy white tees still stand at attention. Perfection lost with only one single drop, a sure castaway. With ancestral courage, his shaky mulatto hands reached in the open drawer and rescued himself. Under Ralph, Givenchy, and Armani, a subtle reminder, there is blood on the cotton.
That is so powerful. That is so powerful. And using those names, those designer names at the end, is you bring it home. You really bring it home. What inspired you to write this beyond a prompt?
If I'll be honest with you, I have a relative who went to a local hobby craft store and saw cotton decoration for sale. And being of African American descent, it stirred something in her. And she called me and began to emote about it, and it inspired the poem.
Now the public knows where poems come from. They really come from anecdotes. They come from conversations. That's really enlightening. That's really helpful. Billy, what inspired your poem?
My poem is called More Than Music. And actually, it was a prompt from the group, but it was at the time of Aretha Franklin's death.
Okay, let's hear it.
Okay, More Than Music. This was more. More than music warming the air with myriad confusions and intruding lights blinking into voices hurriedly hushed to silent expectations. This was more than revelation. Before the curtains rise and the cagey crowd's cries summoning Toscanini to stage, baton in hand, demanding of player and prayer the care and proper tending of timing, tone, and tune, a triune test of violin, viola, bass, laced, palpable masterpiece moments, mystic as Pavarotti's Puccini or Bessie's bluesy blue breath, bellowing the mellowing loud when my mama's Victrola. Mm. This was more than gift. Those sold old hymns, Mahalia, a hosting, holy ghosting sinners higher than heaven, more than grand, standing there outside of staff, line, and space, bringing that grace for grace to music's musing melodies in C sharp major, loosening our moorings as we soared high upon the pyre of startling grief. Mm. Noun. Low in lamenting relief, the lullabies we sing her noun, attuned to treble cleft, bereft, beholding the folding arms and foreboding charms of Miss Franklin's final bow.
Whoa, that moves like liquid gold. Mm-hmm. Are you a singer?
No. No, I'm not.
But you're a poet.
I am a poet.
Almost the same thing.
Yeah, this, it is the same.
How did you get that momentum? What is in you that got that thing from line to line, like a waterfall?
I think I just grew up loving poetry, and I think her death was so strikingly a feeling of loss. Till it just, you know, and I've heard her sing I've heard her sing classical, gospel, whatever. So even the reference to Puccini and Toscanini accurately fit her.
Yeah.
She was amazing.
I love the way your short lines get us from one place to another. Those short lines that will never fail us because they will really flow to the next line. Really good example of poetry. And Liz, what is your poem?
My poem is called The Color of Pain. Reflection is a loud bang as yellow clouds morph into the wind with a nod toward Saturn's pink rings. The day gives no reprieve to the purple-black bruise over her left eye where his fist landed last night. The color of silence is the smell of shame coiled tightly in her throat as she chokes on the putrid scream spreading through her veins, dripping red from the split skin where his knife left its marks and his intentions left nothing uncertain. Fear is the sight of her loved ones trapped by the brown-green quicksand of someone else's rage. The color of death is the sparkle of diamonds dancing on her finger, locking her to her silence, as loud as the gunshot that covers the blue sky over her grave.
The voice of Liz Rizek. We're at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. This is the Right Blend Collective. You know, don't tell me that a poem cannot deliver more than an op-ed in the paper, because that is such a statement, such a picture of domestic violence. And it is so important that people think poetry is such a small voice no one can hear. We say very loud things. You have a service to provide, because that is so beautiful and so powerful. It has a bit of hate in it. That's what works. There is no hate in it. So I do hope that we see a book from you this year. Okay. Diane, let's hear from you.
This poem is titled Your Turn. There is an open field of spotless eyes that gazes back at you, knows your heartbeat, hears the songs of you. A ribbon leans into your spotlight, tugs you, lets you know that it's your turn now. The earth releases its coronet of sounds. Sometimes the loudest echo distorts the harmony, but your ears will only hear the melodies that speak to your heart. Even the earth's drumbeat becomes lost to thunder. The world leaves its footstep in the last march, in the last hope of you. The only murmur that holds you is the sound of her voice. You will need it. Like the beat of drums inside hearts, it keeps your cadence. The sweetest fold of your life will follow her shadows inside corners, too private to share, too new to become old. Don't be afraid of the field of the eyes. They know you. The hills are her shoulders, the ones you've always walked on, relied on. You will run with songs in your hair and dance on the collar of cities that will open and close you. You will blossom in the silent confetti of her gifts that will confess her life from yours. A ribbon leans into your spotlight with a gentle tug, letting you know that it's your turn now.
Diane, it's your turn now. And you have songs in your hair, songs in our hair. Writing is easy for you, isn't it?
It is.
You can tell because it's wide ranging. And she's not constricted by anything. She takes one image and then it bounces off to another image. So that's a beautiful gift. Also, we have to tell you that she is a world-class visual artist. We call her the Picasso of today. It is, you will remember her name, Diane Wilbon Parks, because soon you won't be able to afford her. In fact, you probably can't afford her already. And Cliff Bernier.
Hi, the poem I'm going to do is called All the Winds, and it's an ode to the jazz harmonica. All the winds that ever were blow through this harp. The Scirocco, scorching Africa. The Mistral, storming the Rhone. Trade winds charting the Indies. Westerlies pumping heat from the horse latitudes to the coasts of Capricorn and Cancer. The Pampero on the Pampas. Doldrums in the tropics. All the winds that ever were blow through this harp. From the first star, music of the spheres, Aeolus conjuring cyclones, Zephyr foretelling spring, Phaleon summoning the sunlight, twisting tornadoes, rubados, monsoons and hurricanes, shear, planetary pressure, spiraling squalls, willy-nilly and the dust devils. All the winds that ever were blow through this harp. The winds of change, the four sheets, pissing, spitting, downburst, up-tempo, the polar easterlies, sloping to Derecho, the bees, kissing the Alps, the Buran in Siberia, Rudra surfing the Luz, the jazz that composes life, movement in deep time. All the winds that ever were blow through this harp.
Cliff, how do you do that? Really? How long did it take you to do that?
Oh, I've been playing off and on for many years.
What did you have to overcome, Cliff, to write that poem?
Oh, it came to me as a realization that the breath that moves the harmonica is like the wind, and the winds of the world, and the wind that moves the stars in the music of the spheres, and it brought back Coleridge's poem to me, so that's...
And Hiram LaRue, beloved Hiram, talk to us.
Well, Grace, first off, we want to all thank you for giving us this opportunity. It's hard to imagine how this variety can be held within the bounds of two covers. We have a book coming out. It's called, surprisingly, The Right Blend.
And it's beautiful.
And the cover art is by no one other than Diane Wilbon Parks. So look for it in the coming months, and we're very excited. I think it's close to 90 pages of this diversity of
voices. How many
voices.
Pages from each poet?
About seven, I believe. Yes. Is that right?
But how many poems. Are in the whole collective? Just six people?
Mm-hmm.
This is
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
And you have 70 poems.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I'll tell you, how much is this painting? This is gorgeous.
Isn't it wonderful?
It is gorgeous.
Yeah.
My body
speaks,
does not lie.
I think it speaks to us. Yeah.
It talks about your collective,
yeah,
really.
Absolutely.
So give
the
us.
The variety.
Give us some Hiram.
This is a poem that I wrote with eyes closed, so kind of imagining. It's called Evening. Gnats know how lovely you are. So do yucca spears here on this island that makes you, takes you towards half-held clouds, takes you into rose risks of sunshine and the dip ferns peeled back that reveal such hiddens of you.
Mm.
No one else but you can golden the gnats. Or walk up the sand, shouldering this air like a country.
Thrill me.
Thank you.
Again.
Thank you, Grace.
And again and again. Really, what are you made of?
The right blend. The wrong blend.
There's no one like you. And so now we're going to go around again and start with Diane.
Grace, I would love to read Forestine Bynum's poem.
Yes, tell us about that. Tell us about the Spotlight Poet.
Yes, Forestine Bynum was so kind to write an endorsement for the book. So she read the book, provided a wonderful endorsement, which is at the front of the book. Forestine Bynum, many people may know, was really one of the first people that I know, or poets that I know, to really open the door for diversity in poetry. And so I just wanted to make sure that we include Forestine in this process, because she has had a lot to do with this, and she has a spotlight poem in the book.
Go for it.
Okay, it's called The Dance. I hear the rhythm and the beat of my forefathers as they dance to the sounds of drums, and I listen to the echoes of the tides carrying the moans of a stolen people. They dance a rapid beat of feet pounding mercy into hot clay and jumping with the motion and grace of birds in flight, singing merciful pleas, begging to be spared. High winds and low tides join the beat of the drums and the dance of night. Listen, I hear my ancestors motionless dance. I hear the silence of the drums and the quiet moans carried over the low tides. I hear the beat stop. I feel the rhythm's quietness. I know the sound of mercy. I know the dance of night. Listen, I hear my people.
Perfect pretext for this group. Perfect. He set us up. And Kyan is going to take it from there.
Sure. I'm going to read a piece called Facing South. Like the migrant bird, I turn my expectations south, gathering as many scattered memories from this fleeting sun season as I can. Like bare legs, impromptu picnics, face-devouring sunglasses and vitamin D overdoses, the winter is coming. And I must protect my soul from its cold talons. My wings are in spirit only. I cannot fly south. So I burn summer memories to keep me warm until the south returns to me.
I love the talons. The talons.
Yes.
Perfect. The poet knows the image. Cliff, we're back to you and your harmonica.
Okay, this one is a celebration of the early blues performers from the turn of the century through 1920 or so. It's called Cradle of the Blues. Born in the cradle of the blues, Ma Rainey, C.C. Ryder, in the cotton field, by the Little River Creek, under the rocking sun, made me love you. To the hollers and cries of work songs and tent shows, blackface and drag, Mammy Smith's crazy blues, Memphis Minnie shouting in the street, Bessie Smith walking her man with your 20 gold coins, bone scraping moan, cornrows, rabbit foot minstrel songs, black bottom blues, bow weevil blues, chain gang blues, mother of the blues. And she was born in the cradle of the blues. Born in the cradle of the blues, W.C. Handy, by the tracks to Clarksdale, saw a loose-jointed Negro plucking notes with a knife, going where the Southern crossed the dog. With the sadness of the ages, weirdest music I ever heard, no beginning and no end, like the ragged sun, like Charlie Patton and the water rising, like Son House hitching up his black pony, like Howlin' Wolf shaking his ass, like steamboats and steam whistles. Stubborn Mules, Memphis Blues, Beale Street Blues, St. Louis Blues, father of the blues. And he was born in the cradle of the blues. Born in the cradle of the blues, Robert Johnson, at the crossroads, under the howling sun, sold his soul to the devil for a fast guitar.
like in the churning dust. To Lucille Bogan's Dirty Blues, Ida Cox Raisin Cane, Jug Bands and Juke Joints, to Hokum Blues, Black Snake Blues, Bessie Smith Bleeding on the Highway, Blind Lemon Jefferson Freezing in a Blizzard. From the Fabulous Soil, Poisoned by a Jealous Husband, Walking Blues, Me and the Devil Blues, Hellhound on My Trail, from the Delta Blues. And they were born in the cradle of the blues.
We are better than we were before, honey. We're better than we were before. Okay, Liz.
Well, it's sure hard to follow Cliff there. This one is called Awaken. Wake up slowly. Feel the heartbeat of the world against your skin. Sink into being. The light that flits past outside your eyes, just out of grasp. Yes, that light. Grab it in your first lucid moment and let it take you on a journey past ideas, through right and wrong, above yes and below no. Then, in the moment of stillness, hover over the field so bright you cannot see it, but you can feel it in every heartbeat, with every breath into your fragile body. Wake up slowly, and in that moment, between now and forever, you will know who you are. Listen carefully to hear the voice of God sing your name in that softest lullaby as you find the only path to truth.
You know who you are, Liz, for sure. And we do too. Thank you so much. Billy.
Hi, I'm going to share a really short one called Doo-Wop Boys. Doo-wop boys sit on the stoop while booty short girls speak of stone cold souls they sent to cisterns, hardly winking or thinking that years to come they'll wear a lowered brow, beating their chest in sackcloth and ashes of regret. Yet the boys will go on sitting, singing their ditty, sitting pretty on a southeast DC street, repeating the names of babies flushed and flayed when the doo-wop boys played men.
That's Billy. And we're going to hear from Hiram now.
So this piece is in, I guess you'd say, joy of morning, of daylight, of daybreak. It's called Chanted. Day make candles grinning new as almost firstings light us. Flicker hearts, these swaying points, our telling lives, our yellow glows, all ages gone and holders held, such foliage new and comings kiss, how dawnmost candles feel like May. For circles lift, bring bright inside, for lit and flowing days of make.
Now we know why poets rinse off language. If it weren't for poets, we'd all sound like the nightly news. But not while Hiram's around. Not while Hiram's around. We're going to end with Diane Wilbon Parks, the leader of the group.
The title of this poem is Night. She stood as dark as ever, waiting for me to follow. I chose her canopy for covering and faded into her like clouds. She sleepwalks in my skin, questioning the sound of my moods. We've been here before. Our souls crossed as she tucked the moon in my hair. We've lain on the subtle heels of her slanted cliffs and mountaintops trimmed in heavy coal, sprinkling dust over pitched blue moons and pillows while craving the intractable lips of her rivers. My eyes quickly fold, then flow through her mouth, kissing the banks of her salty lips as she stands stronger and darker than ever, glistening like diamonds peeking out of shadows. She eagerly tucks the soul of wild children, leaving their flesh to become lifeless sentences of old intellect. She wears truth like sandals. I'm left bald with the heartbeat of a wind I can't seem to convince any longer. She drags me into the strings of songs that a sandman carries. I go into her eagerly, night.
The voice of Diane Wilbin Parks, and the group is called The Right Blend. And this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan Family and the Sinipet Fund. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.
This is Medea Benjamin. I hope you listen to Community Radio, KBOO 90.7.
Here we go again. It's the game we love.
Tune in on the first and third Tuesday of the month at 11 a.m. for Winner's Bias, a new show exploring the culture around tabletop gaming. From game nights to conventions, Nate and James share what makes the hobby so vibrant through banter and interviews with local members of the hobby game scene. And if we can inspire a few listeners to join us around the table, all the better. More people to play with. Winner's Bias. You don't have to win to have fun, but it doesn't hurt. The first and third Tuesday of the month at 11 a.m.
This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. In the studios of the Library of Congress, I'm Grace Cavalieri with Natalie Dykstra, who is the winner of the Best Book on Writing in the Arts, the Marfield Award, and that's granted by the Arts Club of Washington, D.C. Welcome, Natalie. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
This is the only literary award for writing in the arts, and is highly competitive. And all these books come in from publishers on film and dance and art. So you won. What is the title of this book and what is it about?
So the title of my book is Chasing Beauty, The Life of Isabella Stewart Gardner. And it's a cradle-to-grave biography of this extraordinary woman who is most known for her eponymous museum in Boston.
This may be the most consummate book I've ever read about a biographical figure because the detail, Natalie, the detail, I am still stunned by it. How many years in the making is this book?
So my first email of inquiry to the wonderful archivist, Shana McKenna, at the Gardner Museum was dated March 2014. So was dated March 2014.
Almost.
So that's
than,
10 years.
More than 10.
Yeah, more than 10. So it was published last year in March, so it was 10 years from that first email until publication.
Is this working every day for 10 years? Either with the research or thinking or studying or writing?
Yes, in some way. I was also at the time a faculty member for one semester at a Michigan college, and then I was living with my husband outside of Boston from January through August. So for those months when I was in the Boston area, then it was really full-time. And then I was able to secure a public scholar's award from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Mm-hmm. which really made it possible for me to work full-time and then also retire early. So from 2020 until the publication, wow, I was working every single day.
She's also the author of Clover Adams, A Gilded and Heartbreaking Life, which was a finalist for the 2013 Massachusetts Book Award. But when did you fall in love with this idea, with your subject, and with this era of history? Has this been always with you, or just one day do you say, I'm just bitten by this idea?
So I have my PhD in American Studies, and I wrote on the long 19th century for my dissertation. And then my first book was, as you said, on Clover Adams, who was a Washingtonian married to the historian Henry Adams and descendant of the Adams presidents, and they lived on H Street. And so I had done a lot of work for that book on 19th century history, and I was also very interested in visual evidence as a kind of resource for biography. So a lot of biographies are about literary figures, not coincidentally, because their archive is filled with written sources. And so I was very interested in how to think about photography in the case of Clover, because she was such a gifted photographer in the years before before Kodak. I was interested in how I might tell her story through the images that she made, to see her life through her camera lens and interpret those photographs in relation to the letters that survive.
I can see how that paved the way.
And that paves the way.
And your writing is pure silk. The details are unprecedented. I knew every necklace and every earring that Isabel Gardner wore. So give us the trajectory of the timeline in terms of dates.
Okay, so she was born in 1840 in New York. She was a New Yorker. The oldest of four children. Her father was David Stewart, and he traded in Irish and Scottish linen. And he was he was rising in the social class. So he ended up making quite a bit of money, but he didn't start that way, right? And so, although he did inherit some real estate from his mother. So
she was moneyed.
She was, but it was. She married into a much wealthier family. Jack Lowell Gardner. So he was from these old Boston families. And his mother was Catherine Peabody Gardner.
Of course.
Of course, from the Peabodys of Salem. And so her parents were very happy about this marriage, this young marriage, because she was married into such an established Boston family.
Well, here's what I was impressed with. You are looking at a scope of history. You're looking at a span of history. You're looking at characters with psychological interactions.
Yeah.
You're looking at the world transitions at that time and the art objects. And I say, where does a person begin? You know, there are so many strands here.
Yes.
That to enter the process is what interests me. What did you do first?
So what you first do is read around the edges of your subject. So I looked at a lot of memoirs that were published in the early 20th century about life in Boston in the 19th century and anyone's memories of her. Not only hers, that's exactly right. I first started with some secondary sources, and then very early on I was working in the archive at the museum, and then I got very scared because of the scale of the projects. For many aspects of the scale, it's her long life. She was born in 1840 and she dies in 1924, so she lives to see modernism. Right? And all those technological changes of the Gilded Age, right? And how the country changes as well. We're not a global power in 1840 when she's born, and we are by the...
Then there's the Great War.
And the Great War.
Yeah.
And so two great wars, Civil War and the World War I. And so, you know, she saw so much
of that
history.
Well, how did you overcome your feelings? Because what did you have to overcome to go on and say, I can do this?
I felt such an enormous sense of responsibility.
Because no one's ever done this before.
At this length. So the museum has published a companion biography, and it's a very good one, to their the guide to the collection, and that was hugely beneficial to me. It came out just before mine, but it was very well researched. And so but there hasn't been a long biography of her in a very long time.
So the book is called Chasing Beauty. How did you come up with that title?
So I came up with the title. There's always a moment in publication where you sell a book with a title, and sometimes you get lucky and it's the one you keep, and sometimes it has to change, and mine needed to change. And I loved having a two-word biography that had a verb in it, because she was so much about movement.
That's exactly what I feel. I knew exactly why you did this.
Yes, she was so much about she loved speed, she loved to move, she was an athlete, she was a dancer, she was kind of always on the move. And so I wanted something that conveyed her that energy, but I also wanted something that was a tiny bit melancholy. Right? And I wanted a word from the 19th century that she used a lot. So I looked both in her letters, and I knew I was attracted to beauty because she was always talking to so many of her friends and to Jack about beauty.
Beauty's natural to me. Chasing is the brilliant word.
It conveys something of her in combination with the Anders Zorn painting on the cover of the book.
Which we will talk about.
Yes, which we will talk about.
Well, we're going to hear a little bit of this book. This is a Marfield Award celebrating its 19th year from the Arts Club of Washington, D.C. Natalie Dykstra is our author, and it is Chasing Beauty. Let's hear a bit.
Yes. This is from a prologue on Notes on a Museum. In her own time and now, Isabella Stewart Gardner seems like a bright sun. We can look around her, but not directly at her. She radiates, but confuses. A relative remembered how she filled the air. Another thought her charisma was like dynamite. She carried herself with noted sureness, with a gliding walk, like a proud ship in full sail. Young people particularly liked to be with her because of how, quote, she annihilated the thought and possibility of failure. She had a wonderful wit. Morris Carter, her friend, the first director of the museum, and later her first biographer, recalled in his private notes, "I said I wished I could find out what was the first thing she did that startled Boston. I said I used to use the word startle to avoid the more terrible word scandalized." She looked as roguish as possible and said that she never did anything of the kind, that she always led a very quiet and uneventful life. She had had many advantages. The eldest daughter of a wealthy New York family, she was educated at a Paris finishing school, followed by an early and envied marriage into a prominent gardener family of Boston. But all this did not protect her from the terrible pain of losing her only child. A friend noted her tendency to be self-protective, remarking that she rarely expressed her feelings directly. She was fiercely loyal. Yet she had a reputation for being an attention-seeking busybody with money enough to boss most everyone around. Isabella surely relished having all eyes on her. Early on, she carefully collected reports of her to-ings and fro-ings in society, knowing that mentions in the newspaper need not be positive to be good. She was often portrayed as imperious and eccentric. This stereotype recast her intense drive, her fearlessness, and her entrepreneurial skills as something far less potent and disruptive, easier to mock and set aside. She had a method to her work, which she explained in an undated letter. "I am obliged to correct my steps," she wrote. "That is, to do only certain things and not to add outside ones. I have a great deal of constant and necessary work to do that I can accomplish only in that way." No one, except maybe her husband Jack Gardner, would have suspected she could accomplish all that she did.
Natalie Dykstra, what we like is that you start with a psychological reason for her drive. Mm-hmm. And we get to know what's exactly motivating her every minute. And it's arrogance, pride, beauty.
Fear, sometimes.
She was human.
Yes.
You made her human. Oh. But she was searching for knowledge and beauty. You wrote those lines.
Yes.
Searching for knowledge and beauty. But our billionaires today are not. When you think of the people that were moneyed in those days, in the 1800s, yeah. early 19, well, they were using their money, yes, for their own private pleasures. They lived well. But they really were seeking some aesthetic that was beyond above themselves. Can you think of billionaires today who are doing that?
I mean, there are so many generous philanthropists in our country.
Really?
Yes.
Who are seeking knowledge and beauty?
Well, who's
not AI development?
Who support the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum, for instance,
yeah.
who support the Museum of Fine Arts, who support all these extraordinary institutions in Boston and New York and all across the country. That isn't just, but I will say this, that the generation in the 19th century, the ones that I read about the most and know the most about, felt this deep obligation to the country because they felt so grateful for everything that it had given them. And they were also closer to the Revolutionary War generation, right? So Boston is filled with these extraordinary institutions, many of which were founded, funded by descendants of Revolutionary War.
Very interesting.
Generals,
very interesting.
And, right? Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
And then, of course, a huge patriotic fervor after the Civil War. This is what we fought for, right? And we need to elevate Americans, and we need to compete with other world. If we are to be a world power, like Europeans and other countries in the world, we have to have great
an aesthetic.
Yes, great cultural institutions.
That is so informative.
There was such fear about what was called belatedness, that Americans knew how to make money. They were entrepreneurial. They knew how to. There was a lot of know-how, but they weren't finely educated.
That is so fine.
Right? So they couldn't compete with
Europe.
The art of Europe and elsewhere.
I love that.
Right?
You have made it very clear.
We were a young country, and there was a lot of conversation about how young we are. We were. And
that's the bedrock of this piece, of this book, in a way.
You know, in one way, and it is, she was very influenced by those earlier founders in Boston of these extraordinary institutions. And she wanted to give to the city and citizens of Boston who wouldn't have the means to go to Europe that experience of a bigger world. Because, you know why, Grace? Because it saved her life.
It was her life force.
It was, and it saved her own life after the loss of her only child.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. So there's so many.
So her life got bigger as a result of all her travels and her eye, her amazing taste, her unending curiosity that expanded her life. And that is what she wanted to offer.
But the hydraulic was the money.
But the hydraulic was the money, absolutely. And she was no saint. She was no saint.
We're going to hear about that.
She was no saint.
This is Chasing Beauty, the Marfield Award winner, the 19th year for this award. Let us hear another reading.
Oh, let's hear another reading. All right.
Everyone needs to get this book because it's a page-turner.
Oh, thank you so much. So I'm going to read about the making of the painting that's on the cover of the book, of the portrait. And this is from a chapter called The Age of Mrs. Jack, which is a phrase in a notebook that Henry James kept.
Her good friend.
Her very good friend.
She hung out with the big ones, didn't she?
She did. And he was... We can talk about her relationship with Henry James, of course, but this phrase, Age of Mrs. Jack, is he was anxious about how many Americans were starting to come over to Europe and sort of crowd its streets. And so he was saying, but this is the age of Mrs. Jack. That's the context of that quote. And so this is the chapter, Age of Mrs. Jack, 1894 to 1895. So she was born in 1840, so she's about 54 years old when this scene takes place. And it's the every even year, she and Jack would travel to Europe, often spending weeks either at the beginning of their trip, at the end, in Venice. This is the one year that they stayed in Venice, in September 1895. So I just want to get that so the listeners can visualize that or imagine that. And one more backstory. Anders Zorn was a wonderful Swedish painter that she was very supportive of, and really helped his career in America. And they're staying at, the scene takes place at the Palazzo Barbaro, which is on the Grand Canal, which is where they often stayed when they were in Venice. Anders and Emmer Zorn arrived in early October from Verona. The foursome, that would be Isabella, Jack, and the Zorns, went everywhere together, to the Lido, to Murano, to watch the glassmakers, to the lush Venice public gardens. When not touring the city, Zorn spent the afternoons painting. He had made an etching of Isabella the year before, which had been a failure, or maybe a little too accurate. He conveyed her hauteur and something of her awkward smile, but he'd not been able to express something deeper about her, how he knew her in these years, alive, in the moment, responding so freshly to everything and everyone. And then, on the evening of October 21, Zorn saw the scene he wanted. She had stepped onto the Barbaro's large balconies that looked out on the great expanse of the Grand Canal. Musicians were playing in boats while the fireworks lit up the sky, making the water shimmer. Isabella urged her guests to, quote, "come out, all of you. This is too beautiful to miss." As she was stepping back inside, pushing against the panes of glass in the French doors, her arms opened wide, Zorn cried out to her, "Stay just as you are. That is the way I want to paint you." He began working that night, and by the next day, he had finished the picture of Mrs. G in the window, as Jack Gardner noted in his diary. Whereas John Singer Sargent's 1888 portrait of Isabella had the rather static quality of a Byzantine icon, Zorn caught Isabella in movement, as if on a stage. Her pose is dancer-like. She is a performer in front of her adoring audience. Her long, shapely arms are thrown wide, her heart available, the ends of her long fingers placed on the windows of the French doors. Her gown, set off by its background of fireworks and lit water, is like the one that had won praise in the Boston papers the summer before. It was again a simple, elegant confection with an airy, diaphanous effect that was characteristic of the peculiar refinement of Isabella's taste. Her long rope of pearls hang almost to her knees with an enormous ruby at the bottom. A bouquet of red flowers is visible at her feet as fireworks boom in the painting's background. She completely owns the space. The painting was later criticized as too much of a draft, too impressionistic, as was current in French painting, but the New York Times reported that the portrait's likeness was excellent. Isabella loved the painting. A few weeks later, she described to a friend, "The portrait of me is astounding, a night scene painted at night. I am on the balcony, stepping down into the salone, pushing both sides of the window back with my arms raised up and spread wide, exactly like me." It captured her energy, her fearlessness, her sense of freedom. Zorn would remember in his memoirs that he'd caught her personality, which he described as grandly majestic, more than most. Maybe this was the age of Mrs. Jack after all, if not in the way Henry James had quite imagined it.
Was he the one that said her face was like a lemon?
That was John Singer Sargent.
Oh, dear. But the reason I remember that is because she overcame that. She found a way to become beautiful.
Yes.
She wasn't naturally beautiful.
Yes.
But she had the way of making clothing a statement.
Yes. And be moved so beautifully like a dancer. She was athletic.
Yes, yes.
Right? Fastest runner in her school. Right. Loved gymnastics. She had a beautiful figure
Yes.
that she kept her whole life. She was very proud of her figure. And it was that self-possession that she came into as she aged.
Well, she had it in the beginning because I think her clothing was almost a defense mechanism against mm-hmm. the animosity she received when she first entered the Society of Boston.
Yes.
And they did not like her for reasons of either arrogance or unconventionality.
Or from coming from elsewhere.
Mm.
So this is in this chapter, Blood and Thunder, 1915 to 1918. Bright colors catch the eye first, blazing reds, grassy yellows and greens, sharp blues. The rectangular panel made up of 105 pieces of gleaming glass is set in a dark wood frame placed against an exterior wall of clear glass. A garden is in view beyond. The panel, located in the Chinese loggia of the museum's first floor, is not very large, though it seems bigger when the sun pours in from the east, spreading rays of intense color over the stone floor. A close look reveals faces of two pieces of glass. In the first fragment on the lower right, one eye peers back like that of a cyclops. The second, larger face is above the first, more in the center and in three-quarter profile. Its half-quizzical expression, eyes looking up, seems to say, "What's this? Where did I come from?" The glass pieces came from the windows of the 13th century cathedral at Rennes, located northeast of Paris, under whose soaring choir France crowned her medieval kings. The catastrophic assault on the city came in September 1914 as Germans bombarded the edifice in successive raids, which set the ancient oak-timbered roof on fire. The lead in the windows dripped to the floor, igniting many of the interior furnishings. Soldiers picked up shards of stained glass scattered throughout the city to set into rings for their sweethearts. The cathedral became iconic as a martyr of stone, and photographs of the first and worst bombings in 1914 were reproduced on postcards and in newspapers around the world. In 1918, when it seemed likely that the city and its cathedral would be completely destroyed, Chester A. Howell, an ambulance driver from Dorchester, Massachusetts, gathered and boxed up 100-plus pieces of scattered cathedral glass. He sent them to Henry Sleeper, instructing him to give the collection to Isabella in recognition for her help to the American Field Service, which was an ambulance service. The panel does not form a portrait or a landscape. It is modernist in sensibility, focusing on shape and color as things in themselves. The artisans who composed it remain anonymous. How to value something created from such a mishmash of materials, centuries, and makers? A mere patch of color, an early museum curator called it. And yet, like everything in Isabella's museum, it is more. Pieces from the far past memorialize the less distant past, one era reaching to another. Isabella Stewart Gardner's life was split into before and after with the loss of her only child. Her grief consumed her. She hid away. She floundered. Slowly, over a long time, she came back to life. The panel made from the cathedral glass memorializes the tragedy of the Great War, but it is eloquent too of Fenway Court with its assemblage of artistic styles and periods, and the woman behind its creation. Mm. Isabella, like the small, inquiring face near the panel's center, looked up. In the blasted aftermath of loss, she put bits and pieces of beauty together into something new. Mm. Life is filled with far too much destruction and loss, and yet it can shine with color and light.
Oh.
She knew both enduring truths.
That is the voice of Natalie Dykstra, and it is the award-winning book, Chasing Beauty. The program is The Poet and the Poem, and it is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Sir Nipet Fund, the Rivada Foundation of the Logan Family, Friends of the Program, Natalie Canivore, and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Mike Turpin's our engineer. I'm Grace Cavalieri.
Listening to KBOO Portland, listener-supported community radio. Stay tuned for Shocks of Sheba, up next after these headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM.